5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
Last time went to Charlie Becker. That Nowakowski flanked way outside. Fernando keeps it himself. I'm going to run.
Mendoza!
Mendoza! Touchdown! Fernando! Mendoza!
Welcome to the Sports Kings from Queens. We're all the sports talkers, royal, real, and straight from the boroughs. Today's Wednesday, January 21st. This is episode 214. I'm Gino, joined by Kevin and Darren. Please catch us wherever you get your podcasts. Like, subscribe, follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Give us a like, join our pages. If you got something to say, tell us. Make your picks with us. We're making picks still. NFL playoffs still going on. Tonight, NFL divisional round done. We're down to Final Four. College football crowns a champion. New York baseball shows signs of life. But we're going to start it off with the national championship. Indiana defeated Miami 27-21 to win their first ever college football championship. They become the 11th school to have a championship in basketball and football. Darren, tell me why Indiana won.
You know, Indiana did something a little different. You watched the first two drives of this game, and you saw that they couldn't handle the defensive line. They started playing the game a little bit more unorthodox. They started passing on running downs and running on passing downs and trying to keep Miami off balance. I think that was kind of the key to the game in the first half. And with that, they jumped out to a 10-0 lead. And you know, one of the other things that really stood out for them is their special teams were special. You know, they blocked the game. We were on a Zoom talking to each other, and and Kevin's wife was a little ahead of him in the broadcast, and she's like, she's cheering and she's rooting for Indiana, so we knew something happened. I'm like, oh, he's 50 seconds behind these guys. And a block punt for a touchdown was kind of a real big deal. They were also pinning Miami deep. Miami had a lot of long fields to go through in this game. And then the other thing that really stood out to me, guys, was Mendoza's toughness. In the first half, he took a shot to the chin that really could have easily been a flag because there was no reason. That was helmet to chin.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like blatant. He went in with the helmet. He wanted to hurt the kid a little bit, or at least let him know he was there. I'm not saying he was trying to intentionally injure. And then we had that quarterback run in the second half where he broke tackles on the quarterback draw on the fourth down, got in. And I think these were the reasons why Indiana was able to pull it off. Kev, what was it that kept Miami from winning this game?
Well, I think lack of offense in the first half. I mean, their first four drives, they had a total of 14 plays and 26 yards. So they could not move the ball at all on this Indiana defense. Indiana did a great job of keeping them down. They finally got a little movement last drive of the first half, then they doinked the field goal off the upright from 50 yards out. Second half, they finally got some big plays going. You know, they got Fletcher's big touchdown run for 57. When they were down 24-14, they got, you know, Bauman on the third and 15. When they were backed up at their own 15, nice play to Bauman, 41-yard play to Tony, 22-yard play to Tony. You know, they started to get some big plays, but the problem is on defense. You know, that very first drive, Indy was faced with a third and 13. They stopped him off sides, gives him another down. Black runs off a 20-yard run, and they score a touchdown. Look at that fourth quarter at 17-14. You had the fourth and 5 play at the 37. The back shoulder to Becker for 19. That was right before Mendoza's run on fourth down. At 24-21, third and 7 at the 48. again, back shoulder, 19 yards to Becker. There was a lack of being able to make these plays on third and fourth down that they couldn't get that big stop to give them to really give Miami a chance there to come back.
And I thought in the first half, what Indiana's defense did so well was they were stopping them on those short yardage plays, forcing the punts, third and one, third and two, and Miami trying to run behind that big offensive line. And though Indiana's D-line undersized next to Miami, thought they really kind of dug in there and really did a nice job of really stopping them and forcing those punts. Yep. The other play that stood out to me, guys, is the last play. The Beck throw, the Carson Beck throw. And they keep talking about on broadcast. I mean, Herb Street's like, oh, he knew he had safety help. He was beaten. He underthrew a touchdown.
Yeah.
He was beaten. The safety is not there. When you watch where the ball is caught, the safety is not even in the screen yet. I'm not saying he doesn't get a fingertip on it or something miraculous happens, but I feel like Beck actually missed a touchdown, which would have actually, you know, changed the game completely, actually. Would give Miami the win. I don't know if you guys saw it the same way. I don't know if you saw it that way, Gino. I thought he was open. I thought he just missed him.
Yeah, I thought he just missed him. I mean, you know, he's running around, so he's not just sitting in the pocket looking downfield. He's trying to maneuver, and I think you're right. I think he just missed him, to be honest.
I think Beck showed that he doesn't have the strongest arm. If he throws it out in front of the guy, you know, a little deeper there, like I said, maybe the safety gets over eventually, maybe makes a play, but at least he gives the receiver a chance to make a play on the ball. He underthrew it so badly that the receiver had no chance to make a play.
And what you also saw, I thought, was a little bit of the older team really coming out with that experience first. The talent of Miami started to show through in the second half. I just think they ran out of time, guys. I think that they were gaining and growing. And Indiana had to make amazing fourth down play after back shoulder catch, after everything that went on to maintain that lead, because it didn't look like Indiana could really slow them down once they got that momentum going. And then with that, you get a team that's never won the national championship before, winning a national championship. I just want to read you guys a quick stat on this. This was kind of mind-blowing to me when I saw this. I saw this yesterday. So Indiana before Cignetti, okay, in 138 years, they had 712 losses, the most in Division I, okay? 42% win percentage, worst of any Power 5 team of all time. Highest AP ranking ever was 4. One outright Big Ten title in 1945. I know you remember it well, Jay. One major award winner, Anthony Thompson, okay? Under Cignetti in 2 years, national championship, 27-2. First in FBS since 2024. 93.1 win percentage. First in FBS since 2024. Highest AP ranking was 1, obviously. One Big Ten championship. First 10-win season in IU history, and he did it twice now. First CFP appearance in IU history, did it twice now. Major award winner was Fernando Mendoza, obviously winning the Heisman. In 2 years, a guy won at a program that was told that you'll never win at this program. G?
But it's much different rules, specifically the last 2-3 years, between the NIL, between the transfer portals. I mean, it's not like he built his program from scratch over a 6-year period. I mean, the boosters came in and gave him whatever, $60 million to spend, and he brought players in the transfer protocol. I don't want to take anything away from him. 16-0, we won the championship. But, you know, it's not like Cignetti built this program over 7 years, and it's through going to people's houses. I mean, this is NIL. This is donors all over the place. There's a big difference to me about this.
Well, the one thing I'll say, though, so I remember if any of you listened, by the way, 2 years ago when we did our college football preview to the laborious show that seemed like it lasted 37 hours, I was blessed with Indiana as a team I covered in the Big Ten. And all I remember talking about was, we don't know. Are players from James Madison that are transferring into Indiana going to translate? And then I remember we were following them. They were like 3-0. And I was like, guys, this could be the first 5-0 season in Indiana history. This could be the first 6-0. And we were just going through it. And you're like, okay, they're not playing anybody yet, but they're winning. Then all of a sudden, they just kept winning and nobody expected it. And then we come back this year and they upgraded the quarterback. They went from Rourke to they went to Mendoza, who played well at California. Like you're saying, Gino, they were able to bring in a high caliber quarterback. I think a lot of the team was a little bit more James Madison based in the first year. I think he got Coogan on the offensive line from Notre Dame. I thought they brought a few people in, and yes, the money was higher. But nonetheless, Indiana's NIL payments are not nearly as high as Michigan or Ohio State or Penn State or just in his own conference, probably not even Michigan State. And certainly it doesn't match what the SEC's been paying players since 1974. We can't compete with that. So though you're 100% right, because he brought in Mendoza, who, if I asked you guys a year ago, is Mendoza a guy that you're even thinking about drafting? You don't know. Now he's going to be the first pick in the draft. He won the Heisman. So you're right. He brought in a special talent that he was able to identify. Jake?
And the one word that comes to mind when I think of his Mendoza's performance in that game is gutsy. I mean, he took a lot of hits.
Yep.
He bounced off defenders like on multiple times. He was running and the defenders are hitting him and he's bouncing off. He took a couple of really, really bad hits. I mean, the one you talked about earlier is one of the ones where, you know, I can't believe how hard he got hit and he just got right back up. And to me, that was a big thing with him is, you know, for me, the word is gutsy. You know, does that translate at the NFL level? We're going to find out.
We're going to see how quick he makes decisions. Kev, classy would be another word I'd use. Do you agree?
Yeah. I mean, he's a super nice kid, good family. I mean, that tough with his mom there, with battling the MS. I mean, but you can tell the family seems very nice. And like I said, it says everything right, does everything right.
You know, all about God and his team. You
know, what was that?
All about God and his teammates.
Yep.
Anyway, so we crown a new champion, G. The Indiana Hoosiers. If you had told me 5 years ago that Indiana was going to win a championship in football, I would have said impossible. But with all the rule changes and an upgrade at the coaching position, they found a way. So I guess we just congratulate the Hoosiers, correct? One last point, G. And Kev, both of you.
Kev?
Yeah. On the podcast last week, I believe somebody mentioned they liked something like 27-21 Indiana.
Congratulations.
It was not bad, Jeff.
Got to toot my own horn once in a while.
Absolutely. Nope, you had to score 100% right, my friend. You certainly did.
College scores right twice a year, right?
Absolutely.
College bowl games and playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Gino was 18-29. Got to be better. Kev was 22-25. Darren, 27-20. Great record.
Finally, but check out my football before you get pro football before you get too excited.
We're talking college right now.
Absolutely. I'm going to take a bow, but then when I go to the pro, I start digging a hole for myself right on the ground.
So for now, we put the end to the college football for now.
Yes, we do.
We move on to NFL. Before we get into the games, New York had a hire this week. New York Giants brought in John Harbaugh. It's a 5-year deal. The only thing that came out of that I heard was he's going to be reporting to ownership and not Joe Shane. That came out this week. That always makes the relationship fun when you're in a draft room, I guess. But listen, it's a good hire. Kev, what do you think?
You know, that organizational structure worked so well for the Jets for the last 15 years with the coach and GM both reporting to the owner. And the Giants said, oh, we've got to get ourselves that organizational chart.
Absolutely.
If there's ever been a lack of vote of confidence for a GM, this was it.
That was it. Yeah.
This was basically it. But here's what happened. John Harbaugh was the best coach on the market. And even if McDermott comes off, we'll get to that later, you can still argue it's Harbaugh. You can argue
Absolutely.
You can argue McDermott. You can argue any of the three of them. And the Giants made themselves legitimate in about 3 seconds.
Yep.
Suddenly they have the second best coach at worst in the division, if you want to give Sirianni the nod for winning an extra Super Bowl. That's really it. I mean, that's the only other guy you can compare it to. Dan Quinn and Schottenheimer haven't done anything. So, you know, it's a big move for the Giants. Now we're going to see what he's able to do with his own, you know, stamp on this team. We're going to find out. But I think that the Giants become – I'm not going to call them contenders for anything yet, but in the NFL, the way it is now, just like we talked about college a minute ago, you know, the Giants don't have a ton of cap space, but they have some. restructure a few contracts, get a couple of guys from Baltimore that want to come on over here that are going to dig in, and all of a sudden the Giants could look drastically different. Plus the talent that was underutilized this year by the defense. I mean, Kevin and I were touting it all year, and they just decided to make us look stupid every second they could. But we'll see if that talent's really there or if it was just an overrated college thought process. But, yeah, Giants are legit.
I mean, you look at that offense there, you know, you think Dart's going to be okay with Scadaboo and Neighbors, especially coming off injuries, but if they're good, if they go out and let's say they draft somebody like Tate in the first round there, all of a sudden they've got weapons galore in offense.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They have the defense, but, you know, Harbaugh, up until that last year, you know, Baltimore's defense has been really good.
And, you know, he's a guy that adapts. He went out of his way to make sure that they had an offense that was fit for a young Lamar Jackson. He went out, made the offensive coordinator come up with that plan, and that's what they did. And so, you know, he's going to sit there and work an offense around Dart. G?
So the Giants did what they should have done and what they had to do, which is he's the best guy in the market. We're not going to waste time. I don't want to make other offers. I want to bring him here. They brought him here. They made him the offer. They schmoozed him. They did whatever they had to do. Apparently, they took him to some steakhouse in Rutherford. They did everything they were supposed to do. Said, this is the contract. We want you here. And at that point, even if he says, well, the only way I'm coming here is if I'm reporting to ownership and not Shane. It doesn't matter at that point.
Yeah.
This is who you want to bring in. And listen, to their credit, to the Giants' credit, it was no fooling around, right? He was available. We brought him in. Boom, done, signed. Let's get him in here. And listen, that's the way you got to do it when you're faced with the coaching issues they've had over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Kev?
Giants said this is who we want. Harbaugh seemed like he wanted the Giants. I mean, it was a perfect match, and the Giants didn't screw it up.
It's it.
$20 million a year is hard to screw up, right?
It is.
I mean, they gave him a lot of money. And, you know, he's earned it. He's been that good for that long. So now he gets to take a major, 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 team. A team that New York, he gets to try to rekindle what happened in New York, which all these guys want to do. So it's a big deal. It's the franchise that revolutionized the sport. Wellington Mara, you know, giving up the proceeds and splitting everything evenly so that the other teams had a chance. I mean, there's a lot of history with the Giants.
All right, let's get to the game. So we had 4 playoff games this week. We'll start with the AFC. So Denver beat Buffalo 33-30 in overtime. It's a back-and-forth thriller. Top-seeded Broncos advance to the AFC Championship game thanks to a 23-yard game-winning field goal by Will Lutz in overtime. Kev, how'd this game get to overtime?
The first half is all about the turnovers. I mean, if you told Buffalo before the game you'd never punt, you would outgain Denver by 100 yards. You would have time of possession by over 12 minutes. How do you lose that game? Very simple. First quarter was Cook with the fumble after Allen had a nice run. But the key to it was right before the half, it's a 17-10 Denver lead. And for some reason, they have Allen running the offense from his own 30 without a timeout with 20 seconds left. He takes off scrambles. I don't know what he did. What, he pitched the ball backwards to nobody? Can you explain what he did there?
I didn't understand it when it happened. I thought somebody touched it that I didn't see. He just dropped the ball basically.
And that gave Denver a free shot at a 50-yarder from Lutz, who made it. So it was 20-10. And then the very first drive, the second play of the second half, Bonita with a strip sack of Allen. The Buffalo defense does a great job of folding up to a field goal, but it's 23-10. You know, you got 2 quick field goals when Denver's offense didn't have to do anything. Later on in the third quarter, you know, Nick threw the interception. 2 plays later, Allen throws the interception right back. And that's why, you know, it took them a big fourth quarter rally to be able to get this game into overtime.
So, Kev, when we get into the overtime, did the guys in the striped shirts have anything to do with this game down the stretch?
No, not at all. you know, Denver gets the ball first. Buffalo elects to kick it. They hold them to 4 and out, punt it. and Buffalo takes over their own seven. Allen on the scramble. Questionable if there was a holding penalty on the offensive lineman, maybe right at the edge of the end zone. Don't know if it would have been a safety if they called a hold.
Hate to call a safety there, by the way. I would have hated to see that done.
You would have hated to see that. I mean, that was forgivable. But then you get down there, and, you know, Allen takes a deep shot for Hardman. And he was definitely held, and there was no call, no DPI. But play after that, he takes another deep shot, this time going for Cooks. And this was the play of the game when McMillan and Cooks, dual possession type of situation. Cooks goes to the ground. McMillan winds up with the ball. And very, very quickly, they ruled that Cooks never had possession of the ball. McMillan is the one that came up with possession. It's an interception.
But did they show us that, Kev?
On TV, they showed us one or two quick replays. But I'm shocked. I'm absolutely shocked that they did not take time. I mean, they review every other damn minutia play there for 5 minutes. And this one was the biggest play of the season for these two teams. And they don't spend any time looking at it.
And Steratore just basically is there like, oh, they probably really doesn't have possession. But you can't tell.
No.
Because, and this happened again, and we're going to get to that game later. This happened in the Bears game later on, and they ruled it a catch. I mean, that was the last game of the weekend, right, G?
Listen, 54 years old, been watching football for well over 35 years. I still do not know what a catch is. And this has got to stop, man. The NFL has to make something. They have to do something to modify the rules, condense the rule down so that it's more precise. But we can't keep going through this where every other week we're still all looking at each other going, I don't know if it's a catch. It can't be like this all the time.
Now, I have no dog in this fight. I don't like either team. It's not like I don't care. I don't like either team. And so, but I couldn't believe that they overruled Cooks. But I'm going to have my issue is going to be with Josh Allen. In that last drive, as they're going down the field, he has Knox open, and he overthrows him. That would have been a touchdown. That would have ended the game, and we don't even get to overtime. And that's why when they say Josh Allen is as good as Patrick Mahomes, I have to say no.
No.
And I have to say because of a throw like that, and I'm not saying Mahomes has never missed anybody. Don't get me wrong. He's been blown out twice in Super Bowls. You can't say that that's not the case. But he has not lost at that level in that kind of situation where he needed to make a clutch throw and didn't make it. Allen had the clutch throw, Kev. Yeah. And he missed him.
He missed him.
He flat out missed him. I mean, this was a great game back and forth. You know, defenses were actually better than the score would indicate to a certain extent. But, you know, controversy from the referees, yet again, the officials, I should say, yet again, there's only one referee. Everybody else is an official. But it's like, Marona me.
Yeah.
Don't even waste still in the position.
Then we still had more calls. Yeah. And that was game winning drive. So you get the defensive pass interference on Johnson for 17 yards.
I didn't love it, but I thought that there was a personal foul anyway, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, they roughed the passer, which would have been 15. DPI was 17. That's a wash. It's 2 yards, not a big deal. But I thought that play was very much the same as the one on Hardman. I thought if they don't call on Hardman, they can't call on that one. Then the other one, after Knicks runs for -2, which was a big play after the game, it turned out to be. We'll talk about that in a minute. Knicks tries to hit Mims, and White tackles Mims before the ball even gets there. I mean, how White can be complaining about that call? I mean, he clearly tackled it before the ball was anywhere near him. And then we'll just center the ball, and like I said, Lutz with the 23-yarder, and game over.
You know, I thought that there was a situation throughout the NFL this weekend where a lot of times they were letting the players play. And in that particular game, they were for about three quarters.
Yep.
And then they started tightening the whistle, which makes no sense. Usually, you want to see the old hockey way, where you have to basically murder someone in the third period to get a power play. This was the opposite way. I thought White interfered. If they wouldn't have thrown the flag, I would have understood why, just because they don't want to make the officials part of the call. But I thought it was kind of blatant interference. G, did you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I just it's just inconsistent. To me, that's the only problem. And it's the same thing we argue about with the NHL. If you're going to call all these penalties, call them. I don't care when what part of the game it's in. If you're going to let them play, let them play. You know, you can't have it both ways mid-game, start changing stuff up. And, for us, we always say this about the strike zone. You can't tell me it's a tight strike zone for 7 innings, and then the last 2 innings, the strike zone is 8 feet wide. You can't do it both ways. Just right. Be consistent with your calls.
And that's all the fans want. But the problem with the Bills is every year they're crying about the officiating. But not even just that.
Post-game,
there was post-game. Even more on both teams.
First the news right after the post-game was Bonix out with a broken ankle. Looks like it happened probably on that run for a loss of two. It was probably where he had the ankle injury. He threw the deep pass, and then when he went for the kneel down, the ankle gave way. And shocking news after the game to find out, the starting quarterback is out for the season with a broken ankle.
And now they go to?
The great Jarrett Stidham.
Jarrett Stidham.
Who haven't thrown a pass in 2 years. And his backup, Sam Erlinger.
Yep.
Who hasn't thrown an NFL pass in 3 years.
He was with the Colts. Good Texas kid. SEC, cares all about it. And then what happened the next day? 2 days later?
2 days later, the Bills decide, maybe it's time to move on from McDermott. And, Darren, you made the post about it on our Facebook page when you posted about Bills firing them. For the Jets, we'd be building a statue to McDermott right now for getting us to the playoffs every year.
We right now have in our stadium, we have a sweater that says Weeb on it. That's what our coaching legacy is.
And he
did it before we were really watching it. You have no idea.
Weeb's winning percentage was 460, I think.
Of course it was.
McDermott? 98-50 regular season, 8-8 in the playoffs.
Listen, he lost a lot of heartbreakers, including this week. It wasn't like his team was ever ill-prepared.
Yep.
What they're saying is what Baltimore said, that we have this quarterback and you haven't won with him, and now we're making a change. The question is, are you going to get someone better than McDermott? And I don't know if it's feasible.
You're going to get someone different is the answer.
Yeah, well, you certainly are. But, I mean, Josh Allen was, I think he had a chance to win that game in regulation. McDermott getting let go, Kev, I thought it was a little – we talked about it. We said McDermott was still the only coach left that could get fired. We said it last week. And Joe was with us. I think Joe even said it too. I think Joe said it first, actually.
Joe was more adamant that this could happen.
And he was right because unbelievable. So now the Bills are looking for a new coach. They really have a bad look right now with their owner, kind of blaming the coaching staff. The GM looks like kind of a scumbag the way everything's breaking out now. Buffalo looks like they're in all sorts of disarray. That could all change right after the draft and they get some collusion. But right now, it's a bad look in Buffalo.
Yep.
And that's their team. So that's all they have. It's not like New York where you can sit there and deflect on 27 other teams. Yep. This is Buffalo. We have the Sabres, and that's it.
All right. Buffalo, Denver will go on next week, and they're going to face New England. New England beat the Texans 28-16. Pats defense dominated a sloppy weather-impacted game in Foxborough, forcing 5 turnovers. 4 of those were interceptions by Stroud.
Gee, how did New England win this game?
Well, it's the defense. The defense was huge. They got some good play from May. We'll talk about him in a little bit. But defense was the key. They pressured C.J. Stroud on 44% of his dropbacks. He had some errant throws. He had 4 interceptions, all in the first half, by the way. Became only a second player in 35 years to throw 4 picks in a single playoff half. One of those obviously was the pick 6 to Marcus Jones to 26-yard interception return. And then in the red zone, Texans moved the ball at times, but New England defense repeatedly forced them to settle for field goals. Houston went 0-2 in the red zone during the second half. They were unable to find the end zone. And the field had something to do with it because it was rainy and snowy and sloppy. But at the end of the day, Pat defense is what really got it done in this game.
I mean, the Houston defense actually played pretty well. I mean, they gave up less than 250 yards of offense to New England. Unfortunately for them, most of that yardage came on three drives.
Yeah.
They had 66, 56, and 71-yard drives. That's 190 yards out of the 250. So the rest of the game, they held them to nothing. But it was just enough because of the way Stroud kept turning the ball over and the defense going back out there again and again. And it gets tiring.
Yeah.
Gee, what was your thought on Drake May? I mean, he fumbled a lot.
So they had four fumbles. They lost two of them in the snow. He finished with three touchdown passes. He was sacked five times, but finished with three touchdown passes. He orchestrated the 71-yard drive, which kept the one-handed 32-yard touchdown pass to Keyshawn Booty, the great Keyshawn Booty.
Great catch.
Listen, that score extended the lead to 12 points. It ended, a big Houston, what Houston thought they were going to come back from. And then as the game was coming down in the fourth quarter, May orchestrated a drive that chewed nearly 6 minutes off the clock. Then they pinned Houston deep after that. I mean, May played well despite the bad weather, despite four turnovers. The game was won because May and the Pat defense, and I know Kev hates to hear this, but the Pats are going to the division championship game again. Darren.
Unfortunate way it goes. But but for us Jet fans anyway, who never sniffed this.
Yeah. One other point, though. Two teams combined for 8 total turnovers in the game. The most in an NFL playoff game since 2015. Championship game between the Cards and the Panthers. Stroud had 4 INTs. May had 4 fumbles. It was just, a lot of bad play. But at the end of the day, Pats get the win, and they go face the Broncos. And as we'll talk about it in a little bit, a depleted Broncos team because their quarterback is down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything else with that game, guys?
The only thing I'll say is there was a fumble early on inside the 5 where Will Anderson, rather than just falling on it, tried to pick it up, didn't recover it. Could have changed the momentum of the game a little bit because they would have had first and goal. Instead, he tried to run with it, then he tried to fall on it, missed it both times. Patriots recovered it. Happened again, not in the red zone, but a couple of times where he thought the Patriots had the Texans had a chance to jump on those balls. They did not, and that's how the game is played, guys. You recover your fumbles, you're in better shape.
Yep.
All right, let's move to the NFC. Seattle Seahawks beat the San Francisco 49ers 41-6. Seattle left no doubt who owns the NFC West at this point, dismantling a depleted 49ers team. Darren, how did Seattle do this?
This is going to be the quickest recap we do. Seattle won the game on the opening kickoff. Shaheed took it the distance. It was a bad, blatant trip attempt to try to make him stop. He missed a mile and a half, and they still threw the flag at him because he stuck the foot out so badly. This game was over really early. So basically what happened, Shaheed takes the opening kickoff, goes to distance 7-0. Obviously, with San Francisco scoring 6 points in the game, it's over there. But you can't just put it that way. San Francisco comes down, and they get stopped on 4th-and-1 at the Seattle 40. And they tried – the first time they lined up, Seattle calls a timeout. They had a pass play called. Then they went to this little run kind of pitch, like little option thing.
The option play,
They got stopped so badly, it was ridiculous. Seattle goes 40 yards, goes up 10-0. You're like, all right. San Francisco moves the ball a little bit. Tom just fumbles, right? So then all of a sudden they come back at 17-0 on a pass by to Smith and Jigma. And all of a sudden this game is basically over, you think. But San Francisco shows a little mettle. They get a couple of field goals. They can't get in, but they get the field goals. And 17-6, and Seattle comes down with the best drive of the night. And Darnold engineers an 80-yard drive, and it's 24-6. And then they get the stop to start the third quarter, and it's over. San Francisco, just everything kind of went wrong for San Francisco. And Seattle walks away easily in this game. Not a lot of yards. Not a lot of great things happened for them offensively, but they didn't need it. They blew them
out. Kenneth Walker, 145 yards, 3 touchdowns in the game, which was just huge.
Yeah, I mean, they ran it down their throat. They flat out ran it down their throat. San Francisco's injuries on the defensive side of the field could not match what Seattle was doing. That offensive line did what it needed to do. Darnold didn't have to do anything.
Yep. And that touch, the one thing Darnold had to do was lead them to that touchdown drive before the half. If San Fran is able to stop him, if they were in the locker room at 17-6 with the ball starting, you feel like they'd have a, still have a fighting shot. But 24-6, nah, it was done.
When you sit there and you have 3 turnovers and go 0 for 3 on fourth down, you are not going to win. That was San Francisco, okay? Then you throw in, right? I mean, we talk about them being banged up. McCaffrey gets hurt.
Yeah.
And listen, the game's out of reach a little bit by that point, but now you don't have the guy that can single-handedly maybe help you get back in it. Seattle dominated the line of scrimmage, the injuries, and I'll tell you this, one of the coolest moments, and then whatever you guys have, you can add to it. After the game, Kenneth Walker ran down to find McCaffrey and shake his hand and give him a hug. Respect between the two running backs. We found out in this game, not the same as what happened to Denver, so I'm not putting in the same class, but Zach Charbonnet tears his ACL. This is a two-headed monster at running back, and it has been all year. So that's going to be the next step that Seattle has to figure out as they play a Ram team where there's some stats in that matchup that are really interesting. And, Kev, why don't you tell us how the Rams did it?
How the Rams do it? It was definitely the second best game of the weekend. I would still put Denver and Buffalo ahead of it, but you know, this was just felt like an old fashioned football game where after a couple of early drives there, 7-7 early, things settled into a real defensive slog there for about 2.5 quarters. And you know, Rams get the drive, 14 plays, 91 yards in the fourth quarter, finally put the offense together, take the 14-7 lead, and then Chicago gets down 2nd and goal to 3. And this is going to be important later. They were down 17-10, 2nd and goal to 3, Swift for 1, Swift for 0, and incompletion on 4th and goal. And I think that's important to think of later. Rams are forced to punt. Chicago takes over at the 50 with under 2 minutes left. They got down to the 14, 4th and 10, and the longest 14-yard pass in history. I mean, Caleb Williams decides to think he's still in college. He sprints all the way back to the 40 to avoid the rush. Off his back foot, throws it into the end zone. And Cole Kmet, after maybe a little bit of a push-off, comes down with a 14-yard touchdown pass. What was that?
Yeah, weighed the guy by 40 pounds, and he was 8 yards clear. So we'll call it a touch. We'll call it a tap.
And so Chicago was able to tie it up there. Question becomes, do you go for one to tie and go to overtime, or do you go for 2 in the win? And I think what happened at the goal line on the previous drive, playing it to Ben Johnson's decision to say, we're having trouble short yardage, let's kick the extra point, let's go to overtime.
You understand the Rams did that the entire game. The Rams were able to stop them on short yardage plays all night, and it's a great running team with Chicago. But I thought that Tooney having them go out to tackle and the backup guard didn't give them that push that they were getting up the middle most of the year. There's no mystery that when Joe Tooney joins an offensive line, that offensive line becomes one of the league's best. Yep. And when you're putting Tooney out of position and you're putting a backup guard, they didn't get the push on that left side, and I think it became really evident watching that game.
It did. And then you get into overtime. You know, they force the Rams to punt. Chicago takes over the 50, perfect field position. I mean, at the 48, or they get to the 48, I should say. And then Williams throws a deep out to Moore, who ran what looks to be a terrible route, curled the defensive back, runs a better route than Moore does to get the interception there at the 22. What do you think about Moore's effort there?
Well, the only thing I'm saying, because I mean, on camera, there's no way not to think he rounded out that route. He didn't seem like he was muscling. He was injured a lot in that game. He was in and out of the game with his head. Now, I'm not saying that was
a reason or not,
but I don't know if he was just going through the motions because he was just being lazy or tired, or if he was really injured, just didn't have that extra gear. I don't know the answer to that, but he was in and out of the game multiple times, hurt. Yeah. And so I'm not going to necessarily kill Moore because he's been a good receiver in this league. But whatever he did on that pattern, Gino, it did not look like he was running it hard.
I agree. The only thing is there a little Jameis Winston and Caleb Williams? Is there a little? Because there are times when he looks fantastic, and there are times where he's chucking the ball, I feel like.
This is year two, so he's got time to grow out of it.
I agree. And I agree. And that's why I said a little. That's why I said a little.
You can see a little. That's a bad point there, G.
A little. And, you know, when he's got these guys open, I get it. Or when they're running downfield, I get it. I mean, that chuck to the end zone for Kmet. I mean, I don't care how much he pushed off. He chucked the ball. He just chucked the ball into the end zone.
In stride.
It's right.
I hit him in the right spot. I mean, Kmet didn't have to do anything. He just move his hands a little bit.
I am not criticizing his ability. It's just he chucked that ball.
No doubt. And the funniest part about it, though, Gino, is that the Bears were lucky this year. They had that luck going all season long.
Yeah.
You don't know you're going to get that luck back. So now if Caleb does not progress off this, because sometimes it looks like he's almost throwing jump passes. Sometimes he's missing guys wide open over the middle. Sometimes he throws that perfect strike to Kmet. Sometimes they hit the Dunze in strike. I mean, he does so many different things, but you know it because you had it last year.
That's
if
it.
You don't have the luck going, to it. He has to progress or the Bears don't elevate, because that division is freaking awesome. Minnesota's only going to get better with a different quarterback. The Packers are there. They're not going anywhere. I mean, you know, you're talking about a division with the Lions who disappointed, and you have to think that they have the talent to bounce back. You're not going to get as lucky. He's got to improve. Like you're saying, Gino, he can't become Jameis Winston or make mistakes, because otherwise the Bears could finish last in this division next year.
And they're going to play a harder schedule.
No doubt.
Because that's one of the things that happened to my Washington team this year. Injuries, you're not the same team. You're coming back. You're not going to get all those breaks that you got the year before. That's what happens.
Yeah. Kev's the Bears supporter, so go defend the Bears, Kev.
I can't. But I'm just going to say, you know, this stuff, the harder schedule next year. You know, when you look at your own division, it's two games difference than everybody else. Well, now with the 17th game, it's three games difference. Yes, you got to play the first-place teams instead of fourth-place teams like Minnesota, but – you know, it's two games out of 17 that are different.
Yep.
Well, but here's the question, though. The Bills go into next season playing two tough games with the Patriots and then four games they're supposed to win.
Yep.
The Bears don't have that luxury.
No, they don't.
You know, that's the one thing. In the NFC West, if your team rises up, if Stefanski becomes the god in Atlanta and you're playing Tampa, who disappointed, and Todd Bowles, who sucks, and you're playing Carolina, who, despite being better, still isn't good – and you're playing the Saints, who, you know, everybody's excited about Shuff because he finished 6-11, or whatever team rises to the top, you can have four or six easy games.
Yes.
That division doesn't allow
it. You can't have that. Yep.
Yeah.
It's more than any other division in football, that division doesn't allow it. So he's going to have to, Gino, you're a great astute point, because he's got to get better.
Yeah, he's going to have to.
But great game.
And then just to wrap it up there, then McVay, I thought, did a nice job of getting that offense into up-tempo on that game-winning drive. I think they found that the Bears' defense was starting to wear down a little bit, and they went up-tempo, didn't let the Bears substitute, and was able to march down the field pretty easily for that field goal attempt.
Yeah, for me, the Rams, a little bit, time to time, got away from the run too much. They were okay with it. Kyren was fine. Even Corum, before he got banged up, was fine. But Kyren was running the ball real well. I think they got a little bit gunslinger happy in that game. Yep. And, you know, you have Nacua, you have Devontae. I get why. It's just that sometimes you got to slow it down a little bit.
Yep.
All right. So brings us to the championship Sunday coming up this week. New England, 5.5-point favorite in Denver. Darren, you want to start us off?
Well, I'm going to tell you how Denver's going to win this game.
Okay.
And you guys will chime in with New England, all right? What Denver has to do is control the line of scrimmage. They literally have no choice. They have to be able to control the line of scrimmage. They have to be able to run the short passing game by setting it up with a couple of deep throws early. They have to show that Stidham can throw the ball, and then they can set up that because they run that screen game as good as anybody. They sit there and run those bubble screens to the receivers more than any team in the league right now. And they have to be able to run that. But if New England's got 11 guys within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage because they don't fear Stidham, it's not going to work. So what they're going to have to do is really kind of try to stretch the defense out, have the passing game set up the running game, and actually utilize Stidham's legs a little bit. On the defensive side, they got to make May uncomfortable because the simple fact of the matter is he turns the ball over. So if Denver wants to win this game, they're going to have to force turnovers. Their defense is not as good as Houston's, in my opinion. But they can still generate a pass rush, and they have a cornerback that can take away half the field in Surtain, probably better than any cornerback in the league at this point. So that's what they're going to have to rely on. And naturally, the stupid thing I have to say, they have to win the turnover battle. If they can turn the ball over less, they have a shot to win. I know they're home, but they're a 5.5-point dog because they're going without a quarterback that hasn't played in a couple of years and is a former Patriot. Now, which one of you boys wants to tell me how New England's going to win this game? Is that you, Gino, or is that you, Kev?
Sure.
All right, go for it.
I think from the New England side, they're going to rely on Drake May to lead them down the field. They're going to try to play this defensive game the way they just played against the way they just played against the Texans. They're going to, the weather shouldn't be a factor. It's supposed to be cold, but light winds, no precip. So, I think that's how they're going to do it.
What would you get to have this game in New England this weekend?
I know, right?
It's a freaking blizzard.
Kev, what do you think?
I think, very similar. Avoid the turnovers, pick it up a little bit what Darren says. I mean, May between the four last week, I think it was two the week before against the Chargers, yep. Six fumbles in the last two playoff games. And yep. He led the league in fumbles. So with Bonito and that defensive line, if they can create pressure. So I think the key to New England, have the offensive line wear down the Denver defensive line and control the game with Stevenson and Henderson running the ball well. I think you need to set up the pass and make sure you get that quick passing game going.
All right.
We're on you. Who's going to win it? Who's going to the bowl?
I hate to say it. I'm going to take New England, laying the 5.5. I think they win this one by 10.
G, where you going?
I have the same thing. I think it's a 10-point game. I think they cover. I think the big difference to this is no Bo Nix. I mean, with Bo Nix there, I think this game is a toss-up. No Bo Nix, I think, changes this a lot. Denver going to a quarterback who hasn't even played a game for them. This is tough for them to overcome. I don't think they can. Darren?
So I dislike Sean Payton as a person. I think he's a prick. Yes. It's my personal feeling. And to be honest, Sean Payton probably, if the rules were today's rules, he probably wouldn't even have a Super Bowl because his onside kick to start the third quarter against the Colts probably allowed that to happen. But I'll take that away. Sean Payton's going to come up with a plan and win this damn game in Denver. New England has never won a playoff game in Denver. They're 0-4 lifetime. They're going to be 0-5. I think that Drake May is going to make more mistakes than Jared Stidham because they're not going to let Stidham make mistakes. I think it's a close game. I think it's low scoring. I think it's ugly. And I think Denver wins this game 17-13. I'm taking the Broncos.
I hope they do.
Okay.
I know you hope they do. I don't know if it's brain or stupidity on this one or just this pure dislike of the Patriots, but I'm going with the Broncos.
All right. So,
Kev, you like the Rams team.
I like the Rams.
Why do you like the Rams team? Tell me about the Rams. How did the Rams win this week?
Well, the two games they played this year, both since November. The first game was at the Rams. They win 21-19. The second game was in Seattle. Seattle wins that classic overtime game 38-37. Back and forth there. Two late touchdowns in the fourth quarter by the Seahawks. Two 2-point conversions. A 2-point conversion in overtime to win it. I think the key to here, the Rams need to avoid the special teams mistakes. They gave up the punt return to Shaheed last game. Shaheed had the kickoff return last week. The Rams have had trouble all year with the special teams. If they avoid that special teams mistake, they know they can move the ball on this defense. And they've put up points. So I think if they avoid the special teams mistakes, I think they win this game because they've got the offense to do it. And I don't think they're afraid of this defense. And then from defensive standpoint, make Sam Darnold beat you.
right. Darren?
Here's how Seattle wins it, okay?
Tell me.
They need Walker to carry the load. Maybe Velus Jones Jr. helps. I don't know. But you need that. You need to be able to run the ball. Couple of stats on this game before I get into the reasons why, okay? Real quick. McVay, 3-0 when facing a team a third time in the season, okay? Road teams 5-15 in conference title games between rivals since 1970. This season, much like Kev pointed out, 1 point and 1 yard separate the Rams and the Seahawks in their matchups. 1 point, 1 yard, okay? They both had exactly 47 sacks this year, so they do a lot of things similar. Seahawks allowed actually 2 touchdowns to non-Ram teams since week 13. Defense has been good except against the Rams. Matthew Stafford, 7-2 in the playoffs for the Rams. The other thing I'm going to say, Darnold, like Kev says, has to be clean. Darnold has to be clean. Darnold cannot throw the pick that he often throws. The D-line on that side of the ball, they have to get pressure without blitzing because they don't blitz. They rely on the front four. If they, because you saw the Bears got pressure, but they had a blitz to do it, and they made Stafford struggle. The Seahawks don't blitz well. They're going to have to get it with the front four, which, you know, we've seen all year long, Seattle able to do that. This is a good Ram offensive line, though. And then you have to try to limit Nacua. Last game was, what, 12 for 270, 275 or whatever it was? Set like a record? You can't. If you're going to let one of them beat you, you got to let it be Adams. You got to find a way to take Nacua away and force them to keep going to Adams. That's how Seattle wins this game. And here we are. Gino.
Seattle minus 2.5 is the line. I think Seattle at home finds a way to get this done. I think it's a field goal game. I think Seattle wins. And from my perspective, we have a rematch of the 2015 Super Bowl between Seattle and New England. Give me Seattle minus the 2.5.
Darren?
Kev?
Me or you, Kev?
Go ahead, Darren.
I gave you all the reasons why Seattle can win this game. I'm taking the Rams. I think that Stafford is better than Darnold in this spot. I think Stafford has the bigger game. It's really down to that. I trust both defenses to be good enough. I think the injury to Charbonnet actually hurts Seattle a little bit more than people think because he gets hard yards and he runs hard while Walker's more of the speed back. And I think that the Rams find a way. I think the Rams are going to do it in a little bit more of a high-scoring game, not as high as that one game, 37-36. I think that the Rams win it 27-24. Kev?
Patriots-Rams for the third time, I believe, in the Super Bowl, once when they were in St. Louis.
Yep.
I think it's a rematch again this year. I'm taking the Rams. I think they find a way to pull this one out. Field goal game. I see the Rams taking this one 27-24.
So we had the same score. Okay.
However, we have three of us, and nobody has the same matchup going to the Super Bowl.
I got the two dogs. Gino, you have the two favorites, and Kev's one.
I have one of each.
Okay. Now,
you said 27-24 in the score, too, huh?
And we have over 7,000 downloads over the years, so you guys have been listening. Don't go with what I'm picking in the NFL. I've been getting my ass kicked lately. Trust Gino and Kevin much more than trusting Darren if you are really actually putting money on this. And I think that would wrap up our NFL, right, boys?
Yes, it does.
All right, G.
Let's get over to some baseball. So we had some signings. We got some New York action. Let's start it off. We were on Wednesday, Thursday. The first domino falls when Kyle Tucker signs with the Dodgers. It's 4 years, $240 million. Opt-outs after year 2 and 3. Huge contract. But it looks like what we've seen is that was the domino that started the chain with all these guys going all over the place. Yankees and Mets both get into the picture. Friday, Real Muto re-signs with the Phillies, three years, $45 million. Then the Mets strike. Bo Bichette, 3 years, $126 million. Opt-outs after years 1 and 2. Let's jump ahead. We'll talk the Mets. So Mets also make a trade. They get Luis Robert Jr. from the White Sox for Luis Angel Acuna and Truman Pauly. Let's start with the Mets. Kev?
And it looks like tonight, it looks like it's Freddy Peralta for Sproat and Jet Williams.
That's
dope. Oh, it's going?
Yeah.
I didn't see that. Okay.
That came up within the last half hour or so.
I did not notice that. That's great.
So
Mitsu acquired Freddie Peralta, Tobias Myers. Yep, Jet Sprout.
So how the hell is Kyle Tucker a $60 million a year ball player?
Gino, I'm going to ask you a question, Gino. We watch the Yankees play the Astros a lot. And when we watch them in the playoffs, I never got nervous when I saw Tucker. I got nervous when I saw Alvarez. I got nervous when I saw Altuve. I got nervous when I saw Bregman. And I'm not saying Tucker's not a great player. He's a very good player. But I always felt the Yankees were able to pitch to him. Am I wrong in saying that those other three guys scared me wrong? Am I being biased against him?
No, I don't think so at all. Listen, Tucker is a really, really good ball player. Strikes fear into no one. I'm sorry. You know, listen, the contract is crazy for the Dodgers, but he's actually a good fit for the Dodgers because they're not going to ask him to hit 40 home runs. They're not going to ask him to drive in 140 runs. They got plenty of offense around him. He can just slide in, hit his 25 home runs, go 25-25. He can steal some bases for you. He'll play good defense. But as far as being the guy for a contract that's basically worth $60 million, I don't see it either, Darren. I agree.
Well, here's what he became the guy of. He became the guy that is going to definitely force a lockout at the end of this coming baseball season.
Yep.
Because now we have owners of rich teams that are going to be demanding a cap. And we have a players association that is not going to allow this. So we are going to have some issues going forward. If it doesn't happen, I hope to God I'm wrong. But I think this might be the last, this might be the final nail in the coffin, Kev.
It's these damn deferred payments, deferred contracts. I think that's what the biggest thing is.
But they're $400 million and well over the luxury tax. They're still doing it. It's just if you combine him and Yamamoto and Ohtani, you're paying the guys, what, you know, $45 million a year? It comes out to $15 million a contract, but it's all going to Tucker, right? It's crazy.
I mean, everybody was concerned about Steve Cohen ruining baseball. So now the Dodgers were there, and they were ready to ruin it first.
Absolutely.
For me, I think the biggest thing with the Dodgers is all these deferrals. I think the deferrals are what's going to cause a major problem. Because if you are paying Ohtani that huge contract right now, you probably wouldn't be able to do this what you just did with Tucker. Yep. And I think that's going to be a huge thing when we get there. Hopefully it doesn't cause major chaos, but we think it probably will.
It's going to be a problem. You can only defer 10% or 20% of salary or something like that.
Yep.
So Kev, now that we get past Tucker, where are we with the Mets?
So now they
signed. Are you happy with what you saw this week with Peralta? Same Peralta's there.
Yes and no.
There's nothing like being succinct and really giving that definitive answer, Kev. Tell us yes or no.
All right, let's do it one at a time, though. Yeah. So, are you happy with the Peralta trade that basically just happened?
Yes, because we needed an ace, and he gives you that ace.
Okay.
Hopefully, assuming there's a baseball season next year, hopefully you didn't trade Williams and Sproul for 1 year of Peralta. Hopefully they can get the contract extension worked out and resign them.
Even if it's 1 year, still probably worth it, Kev.
If they have to make the playoffs to make it worth it.
Well,
if they don't make the playoffs, it's not worth it then.
You kept Tong and you kept McLean, right? So you kept the two best. Nothing against Sproat. Sproat's 2A maybe, right behind Tong.
Yep.
So you kept your top two.
Yeah, McLean, you know, is untouchable. And so now you got Peralta slotting in at one. So that takes some of the pressure off McLean. You've got Tong. You're hoping for bounce back from Manaea. You've got Holmes. And I think they've got one or two other. I'm forgetting another. Oh, Pearson. You know, so they've got enough starters now. And they have, like I said, they have the ace. Bo Bichette, great bat to put in that lineup. Hopefully he can play third base. He's never played it before. Hopefully he's not a butcher there. Hopefully he's better than – hopefully he's somewhere between Mark Vientos and Brett Beatty defensively at third base. And closer to Beatty than Vientos. I'm not making Beatty to be out of Gold Glover. Don't get me wrong there.
Who's the guy that goes? Who's the guy that goes out of that infield? Is it Vientos or Beatty? Are you holding on to both?
Because you have opt-outs every year for Bichette, you have to hold on to both. I mean, they've cleared out the logjam a little bit by trading Acuna, by trading Jet Williams, so you're not having the young guys there. Brett Beatty. You know, I'd rather see Polanco play a lot of DH. I'd rather move Beatty to first, and hopefully he can – we saw him. He can play third. He plays second base, okay. You're hoping he can play first base well enough. You've got Vientos there to help out with that. You know, Simeon's up there in age. Bichette's hurt a lot, so Beatty can move around. You still protect yourself, keeping Vientos. And like I said, maybe Polanco plays more DH because he was a butcher last year in the field of second, and he's played one batter at first base.
I gotcha. And now we get – oh, go ahead, KG. I'm sorry.
All right. I hate this signing for the Mets straight off the bat. I hate this signing for the Mets completely. You totally throw – your everything gets thrown out of whack. You got guys playing all out of position. You know what? You started this whole thing by trading Nimmo for Simeon, okay? If you could go back in time, Kev, do you even do that trade? Because now the trade basically does nothing for you, from my perspective. You're better off with Bichette at second right now and Nimmo in the outfield.
You are.
Okay, playing Vientos and Beatty at third, worrying about Polanco at first, moving some guys around, because this is the exact mentality that Stearns has, where he thinks he's trying to do something, making this team better. I got news for you. There's no power. You lost so much power. Bichette is not going to hit 30 here. There's no way he's hitting 30 at Citi Field. You're lucky he's going to hit 25 at Citi Field. Alonso's gone. Nimmo's gone. I understand you wanted to change his team up. I get it. To me, this is horrible. This is a gut reaction. Tucker signed, and he thought he had to do something. Okay? And I think, for me, if you go back and this is the first move, you sign Bichette, you're not making the Nimmo trade. You're not making it. You're leaving it alone. You don't need Simeon here. So now you're going to play Bichette at third. You're going to have guys who shouldn't be playing first base with Polanco, with Vientos, Beatty. I don't know who the hell's playing first base. You don't know if any of them are even going to be decent first baseman. Forget about good first baseman. Yep. And now, and the other part of that, and I'll give it to you in 2 seconds, Darren. Yeah. The other part of that is, I think it forced him to go get the outfielder in Robert. We have no idea what Luis Robert's going to be at this point in his career. We have no clue. You have no idea if he's going to hit 240. You have no idea if he can hit 15 home runs.
240, by Kev, the way.
Listen, you're hoping, Kev. You're just hoping right now.
What we do know is that the last 2 years, he's played 210 out of 320 games. He's hit 223. His on base is below 300. His OPS plus is 85. That's 15% worse than league average.
Listen, I think it's a snowball rolling down the hill. Now I do think Stearns turned it around with this Peralta trade, because I love this Peralta trade. Love it. Because if he's good, you'll wind up re-signing him and he'll be here. And doesn't matter if you don't have Sproat, because that's Peralta.
Yep.
So for me, this is a fantastic trade. Darren?
Yeah, one thing I'm going to say is Stern started off this off-season about run prevention. Now, Robert is the only proven defensive player that you brought in here. Maybe Simeon, but he's 35. Okay, all of a sudden we went from run prevention to Polanco, maybe Beatty at first base, maybe Vientos at first base. We're going to put a new third baseman out there. We're doing all sorts of different things. I haven't heard a statement this asinine since Hampton left for Colorado for the schools. I mean, I haven't heard this. His whole plan was behind it. Now, I was upset about the Bichette thing because I wanted him. But when he made the trade, I was like, who's going to play outfield? So now they go out and they get Robert. And what we know he's going to do is give you above average defense in center field.
He will, yes.
He's a good outfielder. What we don't know is how much he's going to play. We don't know how much he deteriorated because the lineup around him was so awful and they were just able to make him be a guy that never saw anything good to hit. Or maybe he's just not that good a hitter, and And the best you can pray for is 240, like he said, because 240 seems like it's a distant memory. He had 1 year where he really kind of tore it up offensively. Outside of that, he'll steal 20 bases, he'll hit 25 homers, and he'll play good defense.
They still need 23, played 140 games and 38 home runs.
Yep.
It's the only time he's been healthy.
No doubt. But nobody knew who he was then.
Yeah.
Kevin Moss hit all those home runs. We never saw him again. I'm just saying, you don't know. But the thing about it is, Robert, okay, he answers the question, who's playing center field? Now, I think Bichette should be able to move from short to third. I don't know, but I would think so.
You hope so.
But the problem with this team is going to be first base. You got rid of a guy that hits a ton of homers that's hard to replace, and you're going to try to piecemeal it. Now, going into last year, Gino was the guy that said he wasn't going to. You and I both thought he was going to. Vientos was a guy you were saying, maybe he moves over to first. But off of last year, you don't have the confidence in it. No. If he refines his stroke, great. But we don't know what we're going to get with Vientos either. So there's a lot of things to be nervous about. But the Peralta move, listen, you kept your top two prospects. The Jet Williams thing sucks, but you knew you were going to have to package him somewhere. They decided that they wanted Benj more than they wanted Williams. And that's really the move right there.
Yep.
All right, Yankees. Signed Seth Brown, Darren.
I was pretty excited about it.
And then today they signed Bellinger. It's 5 for $162. He's got opt out after years 2 and 3. He's got a $20 million signing bonus. Full no trade. Darren, I know you didn't love him. You didn't want him back. You wanted somebody else over him like Bichette, but talk to me.
No, I wanted Bellinger over Tucker. I've always wanted Bellinger over Tucker. I got Bellinger back. The only question you can have about these Yankees is simple. Okay, we lost in the playoffs, so let's run it back. That's the question, all right? Are they going to be good enough to be a threat? I mean, listen, they finished tied with Toronto in the regular season. Toronto's made upgrades and lost players like Bichette. So we're going to find out what Toronto's going to be. Boston has made improvements. The Yankees have really stayed status quo. They still need to make one other move. And I'm not sure what it is, Gino, but they have to make one other move to kind of solidify what's going on. Because I get a little bit nervous about them running it back with the same lineup.
One other move, pitching or hitting?
You know.
Now Peralta's off the board.
I'm okay with my pitching on the Yankees.
Okay.
I want another bat. I want a bullpen arm and a bat. Because right now my known bullpen arms are not great.
And where is this such bat playing?
You know what? He's playing shortstop if I can find someone to replace.
Okay.
Listen, my goal is still to try to find someone. I was the Volpe guy. You were the anti-Volpe guy. I'm on your side now. I saw enough to know I've seen too much. I think that they have to try to find somebody at the shortstop or third base position to upgrade this offense. Got to get somebody on the left side that can hit the ball a little bit.
Okay.
Bichette was the guy.
My worry is that Grisham isn't as good as he was last year.
He's not going to be as good as he was last
year. Oh, I know that. But, I mean, is he 10% worse? Is he 40% worse? To me, that becomes the big question for me.
Yeah, with baseball the way it is now, he's going to hit a lot worse average-wise, and he'll probably be only off his home runs by 7 or 8. But the fact is he won't be as clutch as he was last year. That's what my guess would be. Yeah. I think he'll still hit his 20 homers. I just don't think it's going to be in the spots that he hit him last year.
Okay. That's really Kev, problem, by suppose. The way, the other starter you were thinking of for the Mets was Manaea. You missed.
I said Manaea was
I thought you back. Missed him when you went through.
Peterson.
Okay.
Those six they came up with.
Okay.
I think the Yankees have enough starters. I just need that extra arm in the pen.
Okay. I mean, listen, I told you in the off season I thought that you'd get one big move. You got one big move. It was Bellinger. I know you wanted somebody else over him. You wanted Bichette over him.
I did.
But I still thought you were getting one big move. You got a couple of small moves. I'm not saying they're done. There could be another pitcher, another starter, another reliever. You may get another bat. I doubt you're getting a big bat, but you may get another bat. You know, I mean,
I love the left side of my offense, of the infield on my offense right now. I felt like I had more options in the outfield, whether Spencer Jones takes the next step or Dominguez to kind of replace that left field position. I was in better shape than with a third baseman or shortstop we're starting the two guys that I have over there, which makes me a little bit more nervous.
The only thing that you and I don't know at this moment is how far away is Lombard from coming up and playing short? I mean, to me, that's the big question, because if you think he's within a year away, you're probably not making any kind of deal for a shortstop. But it could be a third baseman. McMahon, you know, we know we're going to get good defense from McMahon, but how much offense we're going to get, we're not sure. So, you know, maybe it's a corner infielder, Darren, that can play first and third.
I would be okay with it.
You know, you don't have to. You may not be able to play Rice every day.
Much like the Mets, G, we don't know what we got at first base.
I agree.
We don't know what we have in Ben Rice. We don't know if Ben Rice takes the next step, or if Ben Rice becomes someone that kind of falls off into the abyss.
To me, the only difference is we've seen Ben Rice play some first base. We kind of know how he's going to play at first base. The Mets don't really know how Polanco is going to be at first base. Vientos, from when I looked, I think he played three games in the minors at first base or something like that. So you really don't know in that. We know what kind of first baseman Rice is going to be. You know, offensively is the question for him. All right, the other thing that happened in baseball, Hall of Fame voting came down. We already knew Jeff Kent was getting in on the special ballot. Mm-hmm. Carlos Beltran gets voted in. Andrew Jones gets voted in. Obviously needs 75% of the voting. The closest person after that was Chase Utley at 59%. No one else hit 49%. Listen, Beltran, he's one of 39 people with 1,500 runs in RBIs. He's one of five people with 400 home runs and 300 stolen bases. Andrew Jones, 10-time Gold Glove winner, 434 home runs, 1,200 RBIs. If you ask Gino, neither one of them is a Hall of Famer, but tell me what you guys think. Kev?
Beltran is a little bit of a compiler, and even he didn't reach some of the real magical milestones. You know, 20 years of playing, 9-time All-Star, less than half. MVP, one-time finished fourth, one-time finished ninth. Those were his only two top 10 MVP years. That's a Hall of Famer? I mean, it feels like a compiler. You know, the 2,700 hits, 400 home runs, 1,500 runs, 300 steals. It's Beltran, Mays, and two guys who won't make the Hall of Fame, Barry Bonds and A-Rod. So the numbers are there for his career. I always thought Beltran was an excellent ball player. Like I said, felt like a little more of a compiler, Hall of Famer. Yeah. Andrew Jones? Less so, because Great Glove, you look at his career, and I think it was about 7 or 8 years of really good baseball, and then he fell off a cliff offensively. And I don't think that was long enough peak. Like I said, I think Jones is short, and I think Beltran just makes the bar for me. Darren?
Listen, it's become the hall of the very good.
Yeah.
Jones's war defensively is the best war of any player by leaps and bounds.
Yep.
Leaps and bounds. The second guy is Pudge, and he's way back. But I'm not a war guy. I never outside of the two home runs in game one of the 96 World Series, I never really feared Jones as a batter. Yep. I thought he could hit home runs, but you could pitch to him. I think Beltran was very good. I think Beltran did a lot of good things. He could run. He could hit the power. I think Mets fans are always going to remember the bat on the shoulder against Wainwright more than anything else, and it's going to tarnish him a little bit more. But I think he was a very good player. The All-Star game's a joke. I don't judge it like they used to do it in the 70s and 80s and 90s, even to an extent, because I feel like they just kind of, became just a popularity contest on what team you were on. I would give Beltran the nod over Jones. Yeah. I don't think of either player were growing up saying, well, that's a Hall of Famer. But I didn't think that way on I never thought that way on Kent. I don't think that way on a lot of guys. So I'm kind of in agreement. G?
And I was going to ask, coming up now, you know, Utley was the next highest at 59%.
No. Nice player.
Four or five terrific years.
Yeah, nice player. Nice player. Good.
Then it's down to Pettit.
Listen, Pettit
to me, he's more of a Hall of Famer than these guys.
He's only for the postseason, and he compiled wins. And he compiled wins because he was on good teams.
And then King Felix.
He in big spots.
Neither one is a Hall of Famer to me.
What?
No.
Yeah, King Felix in big spots was never good.
Listen, I know I'm a hard grader because I only want the best of the best in there, but neither one of those guys is a Hall of Famer to me.
I think Bernie Williams has just as good an option as these two guys that got in. I think with Bernie, I think Bernie for his postseason, he does a lot more than these two guys ever did.
I'm not sure.
I don't think either one's better is what I'm saying.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Hall of Famer. I'm saying I don't think these guys are better than he is.
And I'm just saying I'm not sure I agree with that, but okay. That to me, that's going a little too far.
No, I don't think so. To me, he's as good as these two players.
Well, stat-wise, I don't know if he is.
No, I'm just talking about eye test. I mean, we think one is a compiler, the other one just hit a bunch of empty home runs.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Yeah, I mean,
I think with Bernie was more clutch than both of them.
I'm looking at stats. Bernie's got 2,300 hits, 1,200 RBIs, 1,300 runs, 287 home runs. Yeah. He may be closer than those two than I think.
I think that I would take him over Jones, and I think against Beltran it's close. But I get what you're saying. He was not a gold glover by any stretch. But he could catch. He just couldn't throw.
All right. What else we got in sports, guys? Darren?
I just have one college basketball note. I know Kev has a couple gems. College basketball, the transfer window is a 15-day period the day after the national championship. The NCAA finally did something right. Thank God. I mean, such a joke. Anyway, we don't want anybody transferring out during the tournament. The day after, we start the 15-day window. Kev, you got some gems for us, no?
Yeah. So just capping off Indy, 16-0. They are the first major college football team to go 16-0 since 94. That'd be 1894. That'd be the Yale Bulldogs, 16-0. We'll transition now between NCAA and NFL. Heisman Trophy, national champion, and number one overall pick. Angelo Bertelli, 43, Notre Dame. Leon Hart, 49, Notre Dame. More recently, Cam Newton, Jameis Winston, Joe Burrow, and now you're going to add Martinez to the list. I mean, Mendoza, not Martinez. Mendoza. One NFL point, the Bills are the second team in the last 25 years, regular and postseason, to have two defensive pass interference calls on the same series in overtime. The other team to do it, Darren?
Who?
The Jets.
I'm not surprised.
Against Green Bay in 2018.
Things that don't surprise me for 100, Alex. Okay.
High school basketball out in Arizona. Maryville High School beat Kofa High 109-25. Why am I bringing this up? Adrian Stubbs from Maryville played three quarters, scored 100 points.
100 points.
The rest of the team scored nine.
That's crazy.
He had 70 in the first half. He had come close to the state record last year. The big school record was 57. The all division record was 75 for Arizona. At halftime, he had 70, and Maryville's coach went to Kofa's coach and said, I'm not trying to run up the score on you. My kid's got 70. We want him to get 100. I'm going to keep him in the game. And the other coach said, fine, we're going to try to play him hard. We're going to try to play defense on him. And the kid went out and scored 30 points in the third quarter to get to 100.
I thought
it was handled well by both coaches. They shook hands afterwards. I don't think anybody went away disappointed. And the kid only had 6 threes.
He just kept pounding away, huh?
It was mid-range jumpers and drives.
Crazy.
Yeah, like 19, I think he had about 18 foul shots, and the rest were just mid-range jumpers.
Gotcha. Nope, yeah, you got me. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's my points.
I got a couple treasures for you guys. I'm going to start off with a little bit of a boxing one. And we talked about it a couple weeks back. We talked about the Mancini-Dooku Kim fight, right? Doing a little research on this, there were a lot of tragedies that came off this fight. Kim's mother committed suicide after her son was killed in the ring. The referee committed suicide out of guilt for not stopping the fight.
Wow.
Because of what happened in the ring. And then you get the rule changes, but changed right after that fight. Go from 15 to 12 rounds because Kim got the knockout in the 14th. And then Mancini never fought the same way again. So that one tragedy ended up costing three lives, not just the one. And it took away his Mancini's kind of lust for boxing. College football, real quick. The 2008 Florida Gators won the national championship. 41 of those players have been arrested.
Wow.
More than one-third of the roster has gone to prison, the jail, not prison. I can't say they've all gone to prison. And finally, just a little baseball point. You know, more men have walked on the moon, 12, than scored against Mariano in the postseason, 11. And those are my hidden gem. I'm sorry, your hidden gem. My buried treasures for the week, Kev. You guys have anything else before we wrap up?
Wrap it up.
Joe, we tried something. It did not work. We are the Sports Kingston Queens. I'm Darren, here with Kevin, here with Gino, talking about the wonderful, wild, and wacky world of sports. A wacky world where one of us thinks we can make the show faster, and it doesn't happen. Please download the podcast anywhere you get a podcast, whether it be an Apple products, Modified, TuneIn. That person was me, by the way. And, you know, please like what we put out on social media. Keep listening to the show. We have over 7,000, you know, downloads over the since we started, which is great. Want to keep that number going. We have almost 1,000 followers on social media. Want to keep growing that up. And without any further ado, may your sports be with you.